This is a special edition of the Mideast Migraines Weekend program on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 on the FM dial, and normally streaming live at freakradio.org. This is a special program for podcast purposes, as my show of Saturday, July 23rd, was not recorded during its broadcast. I will reread the beginning of Part 1, Chapter 1 of the book Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land by Mark Braverman. And I'm going to go ahead and reread to you the notes on the author. Mark Braverman's roots are in the Holy Land. His grandfather, a fifth-generation Palestinian Jew, was born in Jerusalem and emigrated to the U.S. as a young man. Growing up in the United States, Braverman was reared in the Jewish tradition, studying the Bible, Hebrew literature, and Jewish history. Trained as a clinical and community psychologist, he consulted to federal agencies, private companies, and international humanitarian assistance nonprofits on crisis management policies, staff mental health and wellness, and disaster recovery. He has authored 2 books and over 30 articles and book chapters on psychological trauma, crisis management, and organizational health. Visiting the Holy Land in 2006, Braverman was transformed by witnessing the occupation of Palestine and by encounters with peace activists and civil society leaders from the Muslim, Christian, and Jewish communities. Since then, he has devoted himself full-time to the Israel-Palestine conflict. He has spoken about Israel-Palestine before diverse groups, focusing on his journey as a Jewish American committed to peace and dignity for all peoples of the land, the role of religious belief in the current discourse in the United States, and the impact of the conflict on both Israelis and Palestinians. Braverman is a co-founder of Friends of Tent of Nations North America, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting Palestinian land rights and peaceful coexistence in historic Palestine. He serves on the board of directors of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions USA, the steering committee of Friends of Sabeel North America, and the advisory council of the Washington Interfaith Alliance for Middle East Peace. Braverman lives in Bethesda, Maryland with his wife Susan. For information on appearances and other writings by Braverman, and more on Fatal Embrace, the title of this book, visit www.markbraverman.org. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Braverman, B-R-A-V-E-R-M-A-N.org. Markbraverman.org. Okay. Again, this reading was broadcast on Saturday, July 23rd, but due to technical difficulties, I, your program host and reader, Lawrence Renz Wheel, was not able to record the program. Hopefully, after this program is uploaded to my radio program archives, which is located at radioforall.net, it will be in proper sequence of the readings of this book. Here we go. Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, Mark Braverman. Part 1, Breaking the Spell. 3 quotations. First, from Ethics of the Fathers, Book 1, Verse 14. Hillel says, "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, who am I?" From Israeli writer Boaz Evron, 1981. Pay close attention to this one, folks. 2 terrible things happened to the Jewish people in the 20th century: the Holocaust and the lessons learned from it. In other words, the Holocaust was its own horrible disaster, and then what happened to the lessons that could have been learned from it also fell in largely into disuse as far as Israel is concerned. Finally, third quotation from Yehuda Amichai, "From man you came and to man you shall return. I'm afraid of what the past will do to my future." Part one, Breaking the Spell. Chapter one, The Moment of Truth. Suddenly I knew that the first step toward reconciling Jew and Palestinian was the restoration of human dignity. Justice and righteousness were what I had been hungering and thirsting for. If I were really committing my life to carry God's message to my people, I would have to lift up, as Jesus had, the men and women who had been degraded and beaten down. That's a quotation from Father Elias Shakur, Blood Brothers. Now the text of in Mark Braverman's words. When I was a boy in the 1950s, attending Hebrew school in Philadelphia, once a year we received cardboard folders equipped with slots for dimes. The folders were distributed by the Jewish National Fund, a nonprofit corporation founded in 1901 by the World Zionist Organization to buy and develop land in Palestine for Jewish settlement. On the cover was a picture of a tree being planted by handsome tanned people dressed as farmers. When the card was full, you sent it in and in return received a certificate with your name on it and a bigger picture of a tree, the tree you had planted in Israel. It was fun and it was a thrill. I was reclaiming the homeland. I saw pictures of kibbutzim and orange groves filling the valleys. I dreamed of going there someday. 4 decades later, now a middle-aged man, I saw pictures of Israeli bulldozers uprooting 300-year-old olive trees and Jewish soldiers restraining Palestinian villagers crying hysterically over the destruction of their groves. I traveled to the West Bank, Israeli-occupied Palestinian land, and saw the hillsides denuded of trees to build Jewish-only settlement cities. I saw Palestinian homes demolished and orchards uprooted to make way for a 25-foot-high concrete wall cutting through Palestinian cities, villages, and fields. I didn't buy the story that this was for defense. What I saw convinced me that this was not what the wall was for. Now, each chapter is broken up into normally not very long subsections. Next subsection, the question, what peace process? The Israel-Palestine conflict pulls all who try to solve it into a quicksand of contradiction and enmity. Sputtering efforts at a, quote, peace process to resolve the conflict between Israel and its Palestinian subjects appear increasingly futile to a growing number of stakeholders on all sides, despite the efforts of American presidents, European leaders, and broad coalitions of Arab governments. Indeed, the entire effort to achieve a, quote, settlement appears to be based on a collective self-deception. While appearing to hold Israel to account, world powers give Israel free rein to pursue policies that breed popular resistance among Palestinians and promise to prolong the conflict. At the same time, we hear criticism of Palestinian terrorism and failure to self-govern effectively, while failing to see that the growth of a healthy society and the capacity for development of competent structures of government are sabotaged politically by our unqualified support of Israel's policies of control and annexation on the one hand, and economically by the effective creation of third world dependency on the other. Although there is increasing recognition of and sympathy for Palestinian strivings for self-determination and political autonomy, acts of popular resistance by an increasingly impoverished and frustrated populace continue to be tarred by the brush of 9/11 and dismissed as terrorism. Nonviolent activism on the part of Palestinians, Israelis, internationals, and joint Palestinian-Israeli organizations is ignored by the media. Meanwhile, A civil war has erupted between those American Jews who staunchly defend the Jewish state against all critics and those who fear for its very soul. A powerful, well-organized system of American Jewish institutions, synagogues, Jewish philanthropic federations, political lobbying organizations move quickly to suppress or neutralize any possible criticism of the Jewish state or threat to the financial and political support flowing to Israel from the United States. The pastor who opens his or her church to a conference on Palestinian human rights faces protests and editorials from Jewish organizations charging anti-Semitism. And I'll break away here to remind people, when I read this the first time in broadcast on Saturday, the 23rd of July, I pointed out that at the end of April of this year, 2016, there was precisely such a conference entitled Justice for Palestine here in Santa Cruz, California, at a Christian church. And what Braverman points out here is exactly what happened. The pastor who opens his or her church to a conference on Palestinian human rights faces protests and editorials from Jewish organizations charging anti-Semitism. Let me also point out that this book is copyrighted 2010. It's a six-year-old book, and the conference in Santa Cruz I was referring to was in 2016. Continuing now with the text. Christian Zionist fundamentalists join with the pro-Israel lobby to support saber-rattling toward Iran. Indeed, in the discourse on the conflict, reality is turned on its head. The victorious and empowered seen as victims, the dispossessed as oppressors. New subsection, looking for the truth. In this climate of denial and political obstruction, little progress can be made toward addressing the root causes of the conflict and bringing peace to the region. As the deadlock continues, the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority, the administrative body created in 1994 to govern parts of the Palestinian territories in the West Bank and Gaza, are becoming increasingly desperate and politically weak, reduced to the repetition of demonstrably failed policies. At the same time, the last 5 years in particular have produced groundbreaking writing that focuses on the key issues underlying the present situation. Much of this work takes direct aim at the myths, falsehoods, and denials that have been presented to the world at large and that help perpetuate the cycle of violence and political stalemate. Here is a series listed by the author here of the myths, falsehoods, and denials, as he stated. First, in late 2006, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter published the book Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. In the book, he described the occupation as illegal, in violation of human rights standards, as well as of numerous UN resolutions, and as the source of the current deadlock. Carter wrote, quote, "In order to perpetuate the occupation, Israeli forces have deprived the unwilling subjects of basic human rights. No objective person could personally observe existing conditions in the West Bank and dispute these statements." Pages 208 and 209. Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Next item. In the same year, 2006, professors Stephen Walt of Harvard and John Mearsheim of the University of Chicago published The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The article claimed that the excessive power of the Political Action Committee and the associated coalition of organizations that promote America's massive support of Israel is keeping the United States on a foreign policy course that is contrary to its national interest. A longer form of the article appeared as a best-selling book in 2007. And let me break away again. I just want to say that, as I said in the beginning of this broadcast here, pre-recording set for broadcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz, due to Technical problems with the equipment in the studio. I am, once again, forced to record this program, this pre-recorded edition of Mideast Migraines, on my home PC, which is a pain for a variety of reasons. Not having the more helpful accoutrements of our studio, including a boom mic that I can thrust away from my mouth when I need to clear my throat or cough or sneeze, and a different, more clumsy form of a cough button, which it's not as easy as a volume slider when I need to cough. So, thank you for bearing with me, and let us continue. Next item. In a series of published writing and speaking appearances, Archbishop Tutu, Desmond Tutu of South Africa, who along with President Carter compared Israel's policies to apartheid, called for a global movement to oppose Israel's violation of human rights in the occupied territories. Next, Israeli historians, the so-called new historians, have continued to mine newly released primary sources that present a narrative contrary to the Zionist depiction of the birth of the State of Israel, in 1948, simply as a war of self-defense against superior Arab armies. That's the old narrative. Ilan Pape's 2006, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, revealed that a plan to rid large sections of Palestine of its indigenous Palestinian inhabitants was planned well in advance of the 1947 United Nations partition vote and was carried out deliberately by Jewish forces between 47 and 49. Pape maintained that the subsequent policies of the state have continued to implement a program of ethnic cleansing. Next, a growing chorus of Israeli journalists and social critics has exposed the abuses and illegality of the occupation and the political and social damage inflicted on the State of Israel itself by the subjugation of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Jewish Israeli journalists Gideon Levy and Amira Haas have filed weekly reports and opinion pieces in Israeli newspapers chronicling human rights abuses in the occupied territories. In The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, journalist Gershom Gorenberg showed how the power of the religious settler movement and the failure of political will on the part of the Israeli government resulted in the massive ongoing and illegal occupation. The book demonstrated how, quote, moderate left-wing Israeli governments allowed for and then supported the project of annexation and control that has been responsible for continued conflict and the failure of successive peace initiatives. Next item. Israeli public figures have begun to challenge the concept that Israel is a democracy. There is growing awareness that Israel's continuing efforts to maintain its Jewish majority is a major barrier to the establishment of a democratic society. Additionally, there have been legal challenges to laws regarding the ownership of land and real estate, which were designed in the pre-state colonization era to facilitate Jewish settlement and have been preserved in order to impose limits on the sale of land and housing to non-Jews. A July 30, 2007 article in The New Yorker about Avraham Berg, a prominent Israeli and former speaker of the Knesset, quoted Berg's warning that Israel, and I quote, Holocaust-obsessed, militaristic, xenophobic, and like Germany in the 1930s, vulnerable to an extremist minority, close quote, was in danger of losing its status as a democracy. Next, American and British journalists and former Foreign Service professionals have started to expose the myth of the United States as an, quote, honest broker to the peace process and the distortions underlying the concept of the, quote, generous offers purportedly rejected by the Palestinian leadership. In an influential 2001 New York Review of Books article, co-authors Professor Hussein Akka and political scientist and foreign policy advisor Robert Malley disputed the commonly held opinion that Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Negotiating Committee were solely responsible for the failure of the peace process in 2001. He disputed that notion. Next, public awareness has increased as the result of high-profile cases of attempts to silence critics of Israel in academia, religion, and public service. These have included attempts to deny tenure to academics critical of Israel, cancellation of appearances of public figures such as Archbishop Tutu, and harsh criticism of former President Jimmy Carter's 2000 book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Finally, this one. The church establishment in the United States has demonstrated increasing awareness of human rights issues for Palestinians and has begun to initiate educational, global mission, and advocacy projects, including initiatives to divest from companies profiting from activities that violate human rights in the occupied territories. The American public is becoming increasingly aware that the obstacles to peace are complex, and that Israel, far from being an innocent victim, bears considerable responsibility and must be held accountable. We're emerging from a simplistic David and Goliath perception of the conflict, in which, ironically, Israel has been seen as David, even though it is far stronger militarily, into a nuanced discourse in which journalists, political scientists, theologians, historians, and public figures are participating. It is a discourse in which we as a society seem increasingly willing to examine the true nature of this conflict. Again, this is Ren to Wheel on the Mideast Migraines program, reading from Chapter 1 of Mark Braverman's Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, 2010. Copyright. New section. The Call. In the fall of 2006, I had just returned from Israel and the West Bank. I had traveled there with an interfaith delegation that included a number of progressive Christians active in several Protestant denominations. In the company of one of my fellow delegates, I delivered an address at a church in Washington, D.C., well known for its involvement in human rights and social justice causes. The pastor of the church introduced my colleague and me and listened carefully to our presentations. We both spoke of our deep concern over Israel's violations of international law and the human rights of the West Bank Palestinians. For my part, I spoke candidly about my horror at the occupation, the damage done to Israeli society, and my heartbreak about and fear for my people. I charted my, quote, conversion from a Jew critical of some of Israel's policies but supportive of the Zionist vision to one who now questioned Israel's good faith in wanting to make peace with the Palestinians and who is now willing to cast fundamental doubt on the Zionist project as a whole. I said that I saw the dispossession of the Palestinians in 1948 and the occupation of Palestinian land since 1967 as the root causes of Palestinian resistance, and that I was fully committed to seeking justice for the Palestinian people as the only path to peace. After the presentation, the pastor approached me and said that while he agreed with much of what I had said and admired my passion, he felt that in talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict, we had to be sensitive to the feelings of Jews. I asked him what he meant by that. He answered like this: I have studied Christian history, and I have to tell you that as a Christian I feel personally responsible for the evil of anti-Semitism, and indeed for the Nazi Holocaust. I have been involved as a pastor in social justice work for my entire career, including years spent working with an interfaith group of Christian and Jewish clergy. Until recently, Israel and the Palestinians simply didn't come up. When, however, the issue of the Presbyterian Church's divestment from companies involved in the Israeli occupation was raised in 2004, I decided not to push the issue out of sensitivity for the rabbis in the group, who were also opposing divestment. Close quote. My Jewish pedigree, says the author here, must be impeccable. I looked at him, and with what can only be described as chutzpah from the Yiddish, from the Hebrew, supreme self-confidence, nerve, gall. I looked at him, and with what can only be described as chutzpah, replied, "Pastor, you need to do something else with your Christian guilt. The rabbis who will not engage with you in an honest discussion about Israel and Zionism are not being friends with Israel. We Jews are in great peril, and Israel is in danger. We need your help as a Christian leader and as a worker for justice and peace. Allowing this discussion to be muzzled and holding back from engagement in this struggle is not what Jesus would want you to do." Close quote. The pastor didn't flinch. He neither backed off from his position nor dismissed my challenge. What began then has turned into an ongoing dialogue and a friendship I treasure. What also happened at that very moment was a call, the realization that I had been given a voice. My encounter with the pastor that day is the genesis of this book. Next, parallel crises. In his introduction to Rosemary Ruther's 1995 Faith and Fratricide, Catholic theologian Gregory Baum, B-A-U-M, discusses the Church's effort to reconcile with the Jewish people and rid itself of its deeply rooted anti-Jewish biases. The problem, states Baum, is that, and I quote here, if the Church wants to clear itself of the anti-Jewish trends built into its teachings, a few marginal correctives won't do. It must examine the very center of its proclamation and reinterpret the meaning of the gospel for our times. End quote. Pages 6 and 7 of Rosemary Ruther's book. Baum, along with a preponderance of other writers, both Christians and Jewish, ties the need for this daunting project to the impact of the Nazi Holocaust, saying this: "It was not until the Holocaust of 6 million Jewish victims that some Christian theologians have been willing to face this question in a radical way." In his Voice of Illness, Arne Sirala tells us that his visit to the death camps overwhelmed him with shock and revealed to him that something was gravely sick at the very heart of our tradition. Auschwitz has a message that must be heard. It reveals an illness operative not on the margin of our civilization, but at the heart of it. In the very best that we have inherited, it summons us to face up to the negative side of our religious and cultural heritage. Close quote, page 7, A Voice of Illness by Arne Sirala. Next, The Crisis for Jews. This section will be followed by a section entitled The Crisis for Christians. Here's Crisis for Jews. This book emerges from one Jew's response to an experience similar to Sirala's. It is a mirror image. Many Jews, academics, theologians, clergy, laypersons, particularly those who have traveled in the occupied Palestinian territories, have experienced what Baum calls a moment of truth. It is the reaction of a now triumphant, dominant group to the evidence of where their actions have led in the form of oppression, the trampling of human rights, and the fundamental abrogation of justice, differences in scale and some methods notwithstanding. The reactions of those Jews who have opened themselves to an awareness of the grim consequences of the Zionist project are varied. They range from a tentative willingness to peek under the covers of the Zionist dream to an experience of horror over Israel's human rights violations, to a full-fledged opposition to the very concept of a state created for and run by Jews. For me, there is a bright line that separates those who, although critical of Israel's policies, continue to support the validity of a Jewish state in historic Palestine, from those who see the Zionist idea as realized in the modern state as the root cause of the injustices of the current situation. What often separates these two groups is the experience of actually seeing the occupation up close. This not only produces the crisis I experienced, but also opens one up to an awareness of the events surrounding the establishment of the state over 60 years ago, events officially denied until very recently by Israel and most of the rest of the world. Few who allow themselves to understand the occupation for what it is, the systematic project to undermine the autonomous and free existence of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, in the service of selective annexation and effectively full control of the territory of Israel, fail to see it as a continuation of the ethnic cleansing carried out between 1947 and 1949. Thus, the full realization of what political Zionism has done in Palestine comes home. It is not only the, quote, mistake of the occupation that is the problem. It is the very foundation of the state itself, established through the dispossession and continuing denial of the rights of the indigenous inhabitants of the land. What is uncanny and tragic is that in the current discourse, the roles of the combatants are turned upside down. The Jews are portrayed as the victims and the Palestinians as the aggressors. In truth, it is the Palestinians who have been most victimized, dispossessed, powerless, and pained. In every way, Jews have been victorious and all-powerful in historic Palestine. The Jews of Israel are, to be sure, victimized by acts of violent resistance on the part of extremist Palestinian groups, and the terrorizing effect of these acts is not to be minimized. During its over 60-year history of 6 wars, 2 insurrections, intermittent suicide attacks, and long periods of cross-border shellings, the citizens of Israel have lived under the cloud of a threat they have experienced as unending and, for many, imminent. But the impact on Israelis must be seen in the context of the catastrophic losses suffered by the Palestinian people at the birth of the state, the destruction caused by 2 wars on Lebanon, the ongoing effect of Israel's military occupation on Palestinian society, and most recently the devastation caused by the invasion and bombing of Gaza in early 2009. The attacks on Israel are to be understood, therefore, not as the expression of implacable anti-Jewish feeling, but as the responses of a deeply injured and increasingly desperate indigenous population. At the same time, Palestinian resistance, fueled by the desperation and humiliation of a displaced and occupied people, has been amplified and exploited by political forces within and outside Palestine. Acts of resistance such as suicide bombings and shelling attacks are terrifying, but Israel's overall power and security are not threatened by these acts. Suicide bombings are horrible and shocking, but it is too easy and too convenient to tar an entire people with the brush of terrorism, which is precisely what has happened. The image of the Palestinians as a violent people bent on the destruction of Israel is not a true picture. The truth is that, by and large, the Palestinians are a peaceful, patient people. Their sin over the last 60 years plus has been their relative lack of organization, set up effectively by the British during their 30-year rule, in the face of the highly organized and effective Zionist colonial project. They are paying for this now as they face the ongoing dismantling of their economy and their infrastructure, and the continuing program to disable their leadership and ability to self-govern. Israel, with the assistance of the United States, has taken over where Britain left off, and with far greater efficiency and thoroughness. A growing number of Jews in Israel and outside the state see this, and for us the effect has been shattering. The shock, horror, and crisis of identity I experienced as a Jew witnessing the crimes being committed in my name are not unique. End of part 1.